Welcome to Money Markets and Masterminds, a Citywire South Africa podcast that delves into the intricate world of finance, investment, and strategic decision-making. If you're a fund selector or an independent financial advisor or an institutional capitalist looking for insights, analysis, and expert opinions to enhance your opinion, or your perspective rather, you're in the right place here with me, editor Ruan Uester. Joining us today is Trevor Garvin, head of multi-management at Net Group Investment, to share his key lessons from two decades of managing funds of funds unit trusts, from strategic asset allocation to the rise of passive investing. Trevor has seen it all. And today we get an inside look at what it really takes to navigate the ever-changing world of investment management. Welcome, Trevor.
Ruan, hi there, and it's great to be on your podcast.
Well, let's start with the basics. You recently stated in a presentation to wealth planners that the biggest ally in investing is time. Why is time so critical?
Yeah, I think that's a great question and certainly a good place to start. One of the key investment principles for anybody, I think, to understand is that of the power of compounding. And compounding really works the best from the earlier that you start saving till the day that you need to retire. And I'll give you a good example of that. So if somebody, for example, starts to save 1,000 rand a month when they're 20 years old, and they save their 1,000 rand a month every month for 10 years until the age of 30, and then they no longer save 1 cent. And you compare that to somebody who starts saving at 30 years old and then saves 1,000 rand a month for the next 30 years until he retires at 60. The person who started paying at 20 lands up with more than double the amount of money in their retirement pot than the person who started at 50 and saves for 30 years. So, and that all comes down to the power of compounding, which is really where your money grows on the previous year's growth already. And as you get older and as your time horizon increases, this compounding just gets bigger and bigger and is exponential. So really, I think the key is the earlier you can start, the better, and you benefit through this power of compounding.
Of course, it's investment 101. The more time your returns have to compound, making a huge difference in financial security later in life. But one of the key takeaways from your career is the importance of strategic asset allocation. Can you explain to our listeners why this is the foundation of long-term success?
Yes, I think really, first of all, it talks to a range of different principles again. So starting off with is your investment time horizon, and that really affects your risk appetite or risk profile. So generally speaking, the longer you have till retirement, in other words, the younger that you are, the greater level of risk you could hold within your portfolios. And I guess we use risk quite generally, but here we're talking about risk in terms of growth assets versus other assets that perhaps are protect one's capital better. So equities have the greatest growth over time, but they do come with a degree of volatility. So when we are setting strategic allocation, what we are talking about here is choosing weights to the various asset classes. And when we're talking about asset classes, we're talking about equities, bonds or fixed income. We're talking about listed property. And certainly in the funds that I've managed over my career, we've separated listed property outside of traditional listed equities. So we separate those as two different asset classes. And then, for lack of a better word, alternatives, which are more like absolute return type asset classes. So we set different weights for those based on one's different risk profiles, investment time horizons, and return objectives. And that, I think, really just forms the basis. In addition to that, we add on the layer of domestic asset classes versus global asset classes. And really through that, you're getting just multiple levels of diversification across the asset classes, as well as across domestic versus global. One thing, however, I think that is also critical is you can't just go and set this strategic asset allocation, which really is the statistical weights that give you the highest probability of success over time. What one needs to recognize also is that markets are fluid, markets do change, the investment horizon changes. So one needs to be able to be active in terms of your asset allocation. This doesn't mean being overly dynamic. It just means looking at the current markets, looking at where valuations are, looking at macroeconomics, geopolitics at the time. And one does need to take that into account as you manage your asset allocation over time. So it's a dynamic process, but certainly there's a strategic asset allocation starting point that once you've achieved that, you are far down the road in terms of investment success.
Yeah, Trevor, as you told me before, strategic asset allocation is what you call the bedrock of investing in the biz. Well, over the years, traditional stock picking and market timing have become less effective. How have you seen the investment landscape evolve in this scenario?
Yes. So again, I mean, it's really interesting and on many different levels, I guess. So just I'll get to one or two things perhaps in the second part of the answer, but just starting off, I mean, one of the big changes, I guess, over the last five, maybe it's even getting to 10 years now, as we've seen the market evolve to the discretionary fund managers and model portfolios, which actually is really a full circle if I think back to 25 years ago when my career started. So 25 years ago, my first job actually was at one of the original LISPs or linked investment service providers. It was called TMA, was owned by Fedshare at the time. And it was just in the sort of 1996, 1997, when unit trusts were really exploding as an investment vehicle. And, you know, originally there were maybe a couple of hundred unit trust funds. And then very quickly it went to 1,000 unit trust funds, etc. And that was really the advent of, at that time, what we called wrap funds, which really is another word for model portfolios that we've seen, that we see now today. For 5 or 10 years, the LISP companies managed wrap funds, offered that to the market. And then for various reasons, of which I guess capital gains tax was one of the main reasons, it evolved from wrap funds to fund of funds. And then from fund of funds, we had that for a good 10-year period. They were the flavor of the month. Billions of rands used to flow into them within the wealth planning market. And then it started moving to building block funds. And then gradually from building block funds, we saw the advent of DFMs or model portfolios. So it's really been a full circle in terms of how the markets have evolved in that, from that perspective, which has been quite interesting as a multi-manager, seeing the ebb and flow, I guess, of what are the current methods and flavors of the month from the wealth planning community. So that's, I guess, part one. Part two is then the implementation and how you go about doing the investments. And that's also evolved in many different ways. I think originally, when we go back 20 years ago, it was just the traditional asset classes, equities, bonds, and cash. And for those of us who remember to the 1990s, it was pretty much all domestically invested because there was still exchange control. And I'm a bit foggy in my memory. I think it was about 5 or 10% that we could hold globally. And over the last 20 years, that 10% has increased till, as we know, just about a year or so ago, they increased that offshore allowance all the way up to now 45%. So that's been a material change in terms of how you go about managing the money. And coming along with that, it's opened up a whole array of new different asset classes. So in terms of the last 10 years or so, we've seen a lot of development in asset classes such as infrastructure, which has become quite popular now, less so in South Africa because the infrastructure market is much smaller and it's not really in a unitized environment. But certainly in the global space, in US dollar, UCITS format, there are many infrastructure funds that are available and with daily dealing and liquidity, et cetera, that many funds and multi-managers are investing into. We've also seen development in the hedge fund space, both within South Africa and offshore. Traditionally, hedge funds used to be very often quarterly dealing or at best monthly dealing. And we've seen that part of the industry change to now where many funds are actually daily dealing, which has allowed them to be loaded onto the LISP platforms in South Africa. And that's also now being used more and more by the model portfolios, DFMs within the industry. So that's a whole new asset class. So we've got the generally it's long, short equity hedge funds, daily dealing that are now able to be put into model portfolios. And then lastly, I guess, would be things like private equity. Again, private equity from a liquidity perspective, there are not too many that are in a unitized format, but again, in the global space. So from an asset allocation perspective and building a portfolio, you've seen this development of a range of other asset classes that are now investable within a multi-asset class, multi-strategy portfolio. And then lastly, perhaps, would be just two other quite key developments. The one is, of course, that of artificial intelligence and data analytics. And that's been right in the news with DeepSeek the last week or so, causing a bit of volatility and chaos on the markets. But I think AI is here to stay, and we're going to see much change in that space, new entrants come in, whether it be from the US, Europe, or China. But that's now also creating a new quants type of space or asset class that where AI is used to make investment decisions. And then overriding all of this, just really, I guess, more in the traditional space, is the whole increased exposure and understanding of environment, sustainability, governance, or ESG, or call it sustainability, that many people have built into their investment processes in various shapes or forms. So some people place a bit more emphasis, some people a bit less. But these are all areas that have really changed, where the landscape has changed and developed over the last 10 years or so. So I think as a multi-manager, life has definitely become a little bit more complicated. But having said that, the benefits are that one can increase your diversification across different types of asset classes, different types of volatility profiles, risk profiles, and in that way, actually provide the investors with a better outcome from a risk return perspective.
Trevor, you mentioned all these new asset classes and different ways to diversify one's portfolio. Passive funds specifically have gained significant traction. How do you see the role of active versus passive, or the active versus passive debate in portfolio construction going forward?
Yeah, Ruan, I think good question, and certainly a topical one, and one that I tread lightly on because I don't like hurting anybody's toes in that space. And certainly in the business where I've worked for the vast majority of my career at Net Group Investments, we actually have both of those types of product suites, active funds and passive funds. And then from the multi-manager perspective, we use and combine them both within our products. So really not trying to sit on the fence. I honestly believe that people often miss the debate here, and it's not really about is active better or worse than passive. I truly think both have their place to play, and both comes with advantages and disadvantages. So we see that there is a role for both, And without doubt, we've seen a massive growth in passive funds across the world over the last decade or so. And I think I saw a graph just the other day that for the first time ever, the amount of money in passive funds has overtaken the amount of money in active funds within the unitized space across the world. So what are really, I guess, some of the benefits and the reasons for this? What we've seen, again, specifically over the last decade or so, is that active funds have struggled and been struggling to, from a performance perspective, to outperform passive funds. And there are a whole range, and that's, a conversation in itself of the reasons for that. And equally, I think that that tide will and can turn. And like everything in investments, things move in cycles. And we've certainly had this cycle where passive has outperformed active. But I do feel that we will have another cycle where the opposite happens. But does that mean one is better than the other? Totally not, in my view. So passive brings about lower costs, which we can maybe talk about just now, the role of costs in investing. And it provides things like broad market exposure to the whole range of the market as opposed to just specific areas where that active manager may have taken their house view or their bets. Having said that, on the active side, of course, the key thing that it does is it allows that fund manager to look at valuations and see which parts of the market are cheaper versus more expensive. And one thing also investment research shows beyond doubt is that it's the price that you pay or that you invest at is the biggest determinant of your future returns. So if you're able to invest into something that is cheaper or at a lower valuation than something that is more expensive, without doubt, on a 3 to 5 year time horizon, you're going to generate better returns. So that's really, I guess, the key benefit that active can bring to one's portfolio. So really, we believe there's a place for both. And we believe in blending the two together in various ways and forms and in various weights. And that's how it really we will continue to use both passive and active within our portfolios.
Trevor, you briefly mentioned costs. So let's talk about fees and liquidity. So in one breath, two things that some investors sometimes overlook. What is your take on this?
Yeah, both very good questions. And I think both areas that certainly over my working career, I've learned sometimes the hard way about them. First of all, let's perhaps talk about costs. And the environment over the last number of years has changed often as well in this area. So, you know, we go through various market cycles and sometimes returns to the asset classes, to the markets have really been high when inflation is high, valuations were cheap, etc. And, you know, when a fund or the markets are giving you 15% return, people don't focus too much on the costs because whether they get 14% return or 15% return, they're not too worried because they're happy overall. But when markets provide lower returns, and we went through a period where returns were quite significantly lower in single digits, there's a big difference often, you know, when you get a 4% return versus a 6% return, as an example, it's a 50% higher return getting 6 versus 4. And that's where costs become much more relevant and people become much more aware of them. And I guess this is also where, as a multi-manager, we certainly became much more aware of costs as well. And it talks to our very first opening point that we were speaking about, and that of the power of compounding. And again, if you're investing over the long term and a long-term investment horizon of 20 to 30 years, a 0.5% a year difference in return, in other words, if you pay 0.5% lower costs and hence you achieve a a higher return of 0.5% makes a significant difference in terms of your overall return due to that compounding effect of that 50 basis points that you're generating extra return per year for a 25, 30 year period. So that's really, it's that compounding effect on cost and return that it makes a massive difference. So one, as an investor, should be aware of costs, fight for the best costs possible from your fund manager in terms of the class that you go into for a unit trust fund. And also, I guess that's where you need to be aware a little bit of the passive versus active debate. And if your active manager is not really delivering returns and they're just making money for themselves, but not for your benefit, then, you know, you should perhaps be thinking about the passive options. But costs play a role from a compounding perspective. Then on the liquidity side, equally important. And again, we certainly and myself learnt lessons over the last 20 years on this. Specifically, an example that comes to mind would be the global financial crisis, you know, around 2009, 2010, when, for example, we saw two things, real good examples of where liquidity is so important. But first of all, it was in the hedge fund space. As it happened, in terms of our fund of funds, we weren't invested into hedge funds, but we had some clients that were invested into hedge funds on an individual basis. And really, we know that hedge funds at that period came under massive pressure and had to side pocket or gate themselves, which is where they had to ring fence a number of the assets because there was this mismatch between the liquidity of the hedge funds versus the underlying assets that were within these hedge funds. And suddenly, when everybody wanted to take their money out, they actually couldn't liquidate these assets and hence pay the investors. And they had to stop all disinvestments, redemptions, and ring fence these assets and over a period of time, fire sell them really at big discounts and then pay it back to the clients. So clients lost anywhere between 30 to 70% of the capital value of these assets due to this illiquidity or lack of matching the assets to that of the fund. And another area, which is where we did get burnt going back 15 years, and again, where I certainly learned many lessons, which I've used in the next 15 years, was, for example, on UK property funds. So at that time, we had some investments into daily dealing UCITS property funds that were invested into bricks and mortar UK prime properties at that time. But again, in the financial crisis and when the economy slumped, you couldn't sell these properties at all. There were no real buyers. And those that were smart and had cash were able to pick these properties up at massive discounts. But it was, again, the exact same thing. These UK property funds were offering daily liquidity, but they owned these UK properties that they couldn't sell when there was a big run on redemptions. So again, same story. They were side pocketed and we had to wait a while to get our money out at massive discounts. And really, we learned from that day on, for myself as an example, we now only invest into listed property as opposed to bricks and mortar property wrapped within a unit trust structure as the liquidity profiles don't match. So I think the lesson is just you need to be aware of where you're investing, what the liquidity is like. And there's nothing wrong to invest into something that's not that liquid and perhaps takes, 3 months to liquidate and you can only trade once every quarter. That's fine. But then you need to understand that and understand that you won't be able to get your money back quickly during times of market stress or crisis.
Listening to all these story, ghost stories of Christmas past does make one a bit nervous, but it also shows you how important due diligence is, which is a big part of your process, of course. So how do you pick fund managers that can perform over the long run? What is your process?
Yeah, so Ruan, I guess there's no, we're not anything exceptionally different to perhaps any other multi-managers or fund research places out there. We do the traditional process, I guess, in terms of researching fund managers, meeting them, doing both the quantitative and qualitative research. And what do I mean by that? The one is where you get all their data, their performance history, and you can, on, you know, with your modeling, look at how the fund managers have performed during different market cycles, upturns, downturns, etc. So we do all of that. Plus, we have to meet these managers face to face, do an operational due diligence on their back office to look at their compliance, their fund pricing, that type of a thing. And then, of course, speak to the fund manager and any of his investment team that we think are fit. And I think that's a key and critical role. The two points on that, I would say, is the one is one needs to, in my view, always have a rapport with that particular fund manager. In my experience, I find if you don't sort of get on a personal level with that fund manager, it's difficult to feel comfortable from an investment perspective investing with that person. So I certainly have found that one needs to be able to get on with the manager, have a good relationship in terms of being able to speak to them, find out what's their views, the reasons for their positioning. And then equally is to feel confident that their idea generation is something that is repetitive. No fund manager can get it right all the time, but they want to get it right more than 50% of the time, and you want to feel confident that they have that ability to make good, repetitive stock selection picks over time to get you that longer-term outperformance. And then I think lastly on that is two other things. Is one, having the patience to sit with a fund manager for a long period of time. And tied in with that is equally is to understand that virtually all fund managers go through periods of underperformance. And you need to have the patience and the conviction to sit through these periods of underperformance with a fund manager. The very best fund managers in the world over some period, if you take the investment performance over, say, a 10-year investment time horizon, there will always be a 3-year cycle, sometimes longer, where they've underperformed. Most people will get nervous, get upset after the first year of underperformance, and then a second year of underperformance, and then they go and redeem and sell out in year 3, and they miss out on all the upside then in year 4, 5, 6, and 7, as an example. So my philosophy has always been we spend quite a lot of time, and sometimes I feel perhaps too much time, in researching the managers and making that investment choice. But then what we've really done well is stick with that manager for long periods of time. And there are more than a handful of fund managers in some of the fund of funds that I've been managing for now over 20 years that we've held since day one. So we've held these funds for 20 years, and they have been our best performing and largest contributors to performance over that 20-year period.
Trevor, for me personally, financial journalism has taught me patience, discipline, and emotional resilience. But after 20 years for you, what would you say is the biggest lessons you've learned in your career?
Yeah, I think we've probably touched on quite a lot of them, but certainly for me, it's really, ironically, the sticking to the basics. So the lessons that I've really learned is you need to see fund managers face to face. You've got to build up a good rapport with them. You've got to feel comfortable with them, trust them. You need to feel that they have repeatable investment processes. And then I think it's this whole concept that we've just spoken about, is that you need to have the patience to let their skills shine through. And this can often take a full investment cycle. So my sort of key lessons are, costs are important and we need to just be aware of that. We need to have investment patience. The other thing is to just be aware, as we've spoken about this diversification across multiple asset classes, and have the ability to actively move that asset allocation around due to changing market conditions. And then really, I think it is rather stick with those managers that you've spent a lot of time researching, stick with them for the long term, as opposed to try and get too smart in terms of both market timing and fund selection. And I've seen it so much where people swap and change underlying fund managers too often and too quickly and generally at the wrong moments. And this really materially has cost them investment performance over the long term.
Well, Trevor, this has been an incredible discussion, but that is a wrap on this episode of Money Markets and Masterminds. A huge thank you to you for sharing 20 years worth of investment insights. In short, the investment world is evolving and money managers must evolve with it. To all our CityWise South African listeners, thank you for tuning into this episode of Money Markets and Masterminds with me, editor Ruan Uester, and my producer, Joe Lowe, from the CityWise Studios team. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your network. We're available on all major platforms such as Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Ohono.fm. All CityWise South Africa podcasts and videos are also available on our website. So go register and have a look at our wealth of multimedia content. And with that, and until next time, goodbye.